But it was early in the century.
The first is a death cast diary of the Holocaust Remembered magazine from the Columbia Holocaust Commission. It's there for y'all, so it's
but
free.
It wasn't, that was part of it.
And the second is, can we get our chef out here a second? Chef Tony? Thank you for lunch. And I turn this over to Kat.
Hi, everyone. I'm really not good with the mic, so... Oh, I just have to put it that close to my face. All right, hi. I'm Catherine Allen, but most people call me Kat, so please do. I am the Research and Archives Manager at Historic Columbia, which is a nonprofit preservation advocacy group. We also do community education. And in my role for the last 3 years, I've been the coordinator for the Columbia Jewish Heritage Initiative, which seeks to document Jews in Columbia through oral histories and photographs and a walking tour that's available in print and online. So about 18 months ago, almost 2 years ago, Rachel Barnett approached us, myself and my boss Robin Waits, who's here today, about a new project. And this is very, very much Rachel's brainchild. And she wanted to document every single Jewish merchant in South Carolina for the past several hundred years. And having just done this more or less in Columbia, and Dale Rosengarten, of course, having doing this in Charleston, we thought, okay, well, here we go. And so, of course, we've been working on it for, as I said, about 18 months. We started out, just kind of disseminating a survey and getting some press about it. And then many of you in this room have started sending in information about merchants from places like Charleston and Columbia, but also from places like Ellery and St. Matthews and St. Stephen and North and Orangeburg and Walterboro, and all of these towns of which myself as not a native South Carolinian have never visited and have been not sure where they are. So it has been a monumental task. I do thank Rachel. A huge part of my job is once this information comes in, we have a store name, we have a merchant name, maybe that's all we have, and we have a city. And a huge part of my job is sitting down at the computer and visiting archives and looking through city directories and census records and immigration and naturalization paperwork and trying to document as accurately as possible exactly where these storefronts were, how often the merchant moved around, what relatives they had, and where did they go into business. And as many of you know, and with Dr. Whitfield talking about this earlier, we're having multiple generations of families opening stores, across the city and then across multiple cities. And so it quickly becomes a very monumental task. Rachel has been there with me many days, sitting on Ancestry.com, doing research, looking through obituaries, and it's been a really great experience. I'd also like to really, really quickly thank Mark Swick, who's helped with the website design, making sure I know how to use the back end, handling a lot of the administrative work on this project. Dale, of course, for her expertise, and then Alyssa Neely, for any time I say, Dale, do you have a photo of this person? Or, excuse me, Alyssa, do you have a photo of this person? And this goes to both of them. And then I get a response like an hour later with a Dropbox full of images that we are able to use and who I should contact for permission. So thank you. This would not be possible without either one of you. And it would not be possible without many of you continuing to contribute to this project. We have over 100 entries so far that are available on the website that you'll be able to view later tonight. But, in my list, we have 10 or 15 more I can think off the top of my head that need to be done. So, with that said, I'm really excited to have our panelists here. We've put together kind of a four-part, talk. We're talking about identity, so the early history of some of these cities that these merchants were in, kind of the Great Depression and World War II and how those affected businesses. The mid-century period and looking at desegregation, and then also, of course, the later period and some philanthropic aspects of these merchants. And so with that said, I will turn this over to Harold and just briefly introduce yourself and your relationship to the merchant in question.
Thank you, Kat. I'm delighted and honored to be here. And Dr. Whitfield said it all. He really did. I think everything that he said was pertinent to what we're all going to talk about today. I'm Harold Brody from Sumter. I'm the son of Abram Brody from Sumter and Sarah Pearlstein from Oler, South Carolina. And it's amazing how the time flies. I think that my father was number 5 of 10 Brody brothers and one of the 4 founders of Brody Brothers Dry Goods Company. And the 10 Brody brothers, and there was one sister, Ruth Brody Greenberg, whose 2 sons, Phil and Stuart, I'm sure most of you know, who have been involved in this organization. So I'm very pleased to be here, and thank you very much.
Hello, I am Deborah Littman-Koshlin, and currently I live in Seattle, Washington. I'm the daughter of Manita and Wilfred Littman. I grew up in Charleston and on Sullivan's Island. And I am talking today about some relatives who were in the hamlet of St. Stephen. In fact, when I said to Dale, she said, "Where is St. Stephen?" I felt like saying, "You've been here how long?" So at any rate, I took off and I wrote about my great-great-uncle Gus Rittenberg, who was Sam Rittenberg's brother. My great-uncle Arthur Littman, who was Max Littman's brother, and then there's the Reed family, to whom I have no connection, except the fact that the Littmans and the Reeds had a star together.
Hi, I'm Mickey Rosenblum. I think a lot of you know me. I'm Milton and Freddie's daughter. Milton was one of 4 brothers. Oh, sorry. I'm not used to this. Never done this. Okay. Milton was the 3rd of 4 brothers. They were born and lived in Tilghman Island, Maryland, a small island on the Chesapeake Bay. Their father was the only Jewish merchant on the island, and my grandfather died when he was 39, leaving my grandmother with 4 boys. And so she took them and moved to Baltimore. And my saga is one that started with my Uncle Edward, who was the oldest, who my grandmother sent down to Charleston from Baltimore and lived. Am I telling too much now? I'm telling too much now. But I am the 2nd child of Milton and Freddie, and the saga is about my Uncle Edward, mostly, as he founded the whole store saga.
I'm David Fershgott, substituting for my cousin Allison Walsh, who has done a lot of family research, filling in for her as she was not able to come, but I'm glad to be here and glad to be back in Charleston. I'm the son of Max and Marcel Fershgott, and talking about a business that pre-existed probably everybody in this room's lives. It began in the 1860s in Charleston, and continued in Charleston to the 1930s, and then its subsidiary store in Jacksonville continued until the 1980s. So we'll talk more about that in a few minutes.
Hi, everyone. I'm Zach Solomon. I'm Melvin and Judy Solomon's son. I'm here to represent both the Solomon family as we get to the later time, as well as the Prostowski family. These two joined together, and I have some stories for how that came about.
I love it. I'm not sure. Thank you. I'm going to immediately hand this back to you. So we're going to start with David. So we can talk a little bit about post-Civil War Charleston when the Fershgott brothers arrived. So can you share the story of their arrival in the city and kind of their early business model?
Yeah.
Set the scene.
Set the scene. Actually, the story begins in what is now Slovakia, where my ancestors migrated, who migrated to South Carolina through New York in the 1860s. They came from my great-grandfather and his brother came at age 16 and 19 to New York. They were, the reason for coming, as best I can tell, is because of the Kossuth Revolution that took place in the mid-1800s, that they sided against the, with the Hungarians against, against the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was not a favorable thing. So they left and they joined an uncle, who was in New York, who was well up enough to take care of them, I believe. That's a supposition. That's not been proven. That part's not been proven. 1865, they moved to Charleston. And the reason they came to Charleston is not clear. And they opened their stores here in 1866. First store was located on the southwest corner of Calhoun and King Street, in a building that no longer exists, across from where the Francis Marion now is. They moved four times within a matter of about 4 or 5 years in that immediate neighborhood, and gradually over periods of time, until 1921, they moved up, down King Street. It's up technically if you're really talking about going north. It's really, they moved down King Street, I guess, to what is now the location of Charleston Place. They went at the northeast corner of what's Charleston Place now, with their main store, advertised as being in the bend of King Street. The reasons exactly for why they came here probably had to do with opportunity, as was spoken about earlier, at the end of the Civil War, and the chance to begin a business in a place that didn't have major business of that sort going on at that time, and they did quite well here. One brother then, a couple of years later, went on to Jacksonville to open the store. The store in Jacksonville lasted through other relatives.
Florida.
The Jacksonville stores closed in the 1980s. Several generations of iterations. A third brother joined them. He went out west and had a number of failed stores out there. But in South Carolina, the main store was here in Charleston. My grandfather's generation, which is a generation after that, also comprised of three brothers, took over the store from Max Verschkott, not my father, but my great grandfather, for whom my father was named. My grandfather and his two brothers split up at the time of the Depression and went in different directions. One staying here to run the store, and the other two going off in other directions around the state. Is that sufficient?
You want to briefly talk about the uncle in Blackville?
Oh, that's actually a different line. That's the Brown family. My great paternal grandmother's family. My grandmother was from Orangeburg. Her name was Sorrentrue. Her mother's name was Brown, and Simon Brown had a store in Blackville, South Carolina. He came as a cobbler prior to the Civil War in the 1850s, opened a store there and acquired quite a large amount of land there. He's quoted in Robert Rosen's book, cited in Robert's book as being one of the Confederate Jews that fought. An interesting thing about Simon is that he left where his family was in Germany originally, it would have been Prussia, I guess, at the time, to avoid the draft there, came with his wife to New York, apparently, according to his family lore, got involved with anarchists in New York, and his wife made him move south. Moved south, not too long, established his business in Blackville, had quite a large farm there, and probably had slaves. The general store, which is still, the building still exists in Blackville. Simon Brown's house is on the historic register there and is considered a historic site locally there. And he had 13 children, and
he got captured right after going into the Confederate Army, not too many months afterward, and was released later when there was at some point. So, initially, but he was the sole merchant there for a long, for, in that small village for a long time as well.
So Deborah, can you talk a little bit about what St. Stephen was like at the turn of the century and how Jewish merchants altered the cultural and economic landscape?
Well, I think probably St. Stephen was much like it was, like today, like it was back then. It was just a stop in the road. And there wasn't a lot going on, and to the best of my knowledge, there wasn't a store owned by a Jewish merchant until I'm just going to call him Uncle Gus, started one in 1910, or he was already established there. And I think it was a general store, I'm not quite sure, but then my Uncle Arthur didn't move in with his store until 1925. And the Reeds arrived in 1928. So those were the only three stores that were owned by Jewish merchants. It was pretty bleak, and this was a period of time after the Civil War, still about 30 years, and all of the plantations had dissolved. The economic situation was just horrible, and everybody was trying to figure out what they wanted to do next. And so there wasn't a whole lot of culture going on, and so there wasn't a lot of identity. I think it was mostly, from what I have researched, mostly an agrarian community. But that's about it.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the railroad?
And there, well, as most people probably know, I think they would know, the railroad started growing and expanding in the late 1800s. And the railroads brought some growth and opportunity to St. Stephen. I know that Uncle Gus had a sawmill in 1918, and there was a railroad spur leading off the main track to his sawmill, and had it not been for that spur, he wouldn't have had a sawmill. The timber industry was a growth industry nationwide. Coming from the north, having lived in the Northwest now for a very long time, I have quite an awareness because of the Weyerhaeuser family and the great timber barons out there. But that wasn't exclusive to the Northwest. That was just a touch of it. But there was timber industry in South Carolina too, because I know that my great-grandfather, who had timber leases in Ridgeland, South Carolina, and Jasper and Beaufort. So it was inclusive in the state, and it allowed for not only the movement of lumber, but also goods and supplies that they could bring to the communities so that they could at least start to prosper. There was a depot in St. Stephen, and it also provided transportation to these small towns where other people formerly were relegated to only horse and buggies and carriages, which also goes to the fact that there were even spaces next to the Reed store in the 1950s and 60s for customers who traveled by horse and buggy still. And that was a great shocker to me. I mean, time really said still.
Yeah. Can you pass it down to Mr. Solomon? So Sam Solomon arrived in Charleston at a much different time than the first Scott brothers. Can you describe kind of the Charleston that he experienced and some of his early jobs?
I think when my grandfather came over, it was kind of like returning to Poland, because the Prostaskis were already established here. They were from the same small town, and they took the opportunity to bring people in to sponsor them, and they sponsored my grandfather and his sister when they came. And there was some kind of deal cut between the Prostowskis and my grandfather's last name was Ryszewski. When he came through Ellis Island, they changed it. Because many years later, my father was at a play on Broadway, and it was intermission, and he was talking, because my father never met a stranger. And the woman said, "I hear your accent. Where are you from?" And he goes, Charleston, South Carolina. The woman goes, I only know one person from Charleston, South Carolina, and that was because my father fell in love with a woman and her three brothers chased him out of town. Do you know Sophie Prostowski? And he goes, that's my mother. So, you know, when they got here, when he got here, everyone was talking about these small towns. Well, a European concept was peddling, you know. So as more and more people came here, originally the Prostowskis staked my grandfather to a pack. And then as he became more and more accomplished, he established a dry goods store so he could send other peddlers out. So that's kind of, he was still really committed to the rural populations and operating out of Charleston. So that was kind of like where he started.
That's great. So this
question is for Harold. So in terms of size and location, Sumter is neither a large city like Charleston or a small crossroads town like St. Stephen. Can you help us understand what Sumter was like in the early 20th century, both in general but specifically for the Brody family?
Well, Sumter in 1913 at the first store when my grandfather, Hyman Joseph Brody, came down from New York and was told how nice it was in the South, the population was about 8,500. And the town needed a store, and my grandfather was a cobbler and had learned the art in Minsk, Poland when he came over. And Sumter was the seat of Sumter County, and they had textiles, they had a hospital there, cotton, peaches. The peach industry, of course, with the Barnetts and the Levi's around Sumter. So the economy depended upon the farmers in the outlying towns with tobacco and peaches, especially outside of Sumter. The local merchants were willing to interact with the black population, as Dr. Whitfield told us. And I think that was very important. The initial store, of course, tailored to the lower economic brackets. And it's interesting that the ability to loan money for young blacks to make something of themselves or to go to Morris College or one of the smaller black colleges, there's also Claflin College and colleges in Columbia, would not only intensify their reputations but would also go far in helping people. And so I think that was the case with my family early on, and customers would come in from the smaller towns in cars packed with people on the weekends to shop. It's interesting that the local merchants that were, they were willing to interact with blacks, but the Christians were not so, they had local social clubs and they excluded Jews. And the social clubs in Sumter that excluded Jews would eventually take in one Jew from the Levy family, who were German Jews, and who, in coming in, would exclude the Ashkenazi Jews who came in who were uneducated at the time. And this went on, especially in the 30s and the 40s, and they were very careful not to select to enter these clubs anyone that had an accent, as my family did, being Ashkenazi, or had very little education. And that, of course, changed at the end of World War II when Hitler leveled the playing field. So the population of Sumter in 1913, as I said, was 8,500. Shaw Air Force Base was 10 miles out and was founded in 1941. And eventually Sumter annexed Shaw, but that was not until like the 70s. In 1929, when the Brodies expanded, the population had expanded to 11,000. And goods arrived by truck from Atlantic coastline because the depots were vitally important to all of the smaller towns. And they would then come from the railroad to the truck to the stores. And the higher level goods from the Capitol Department Store in 1934, when the population had expanded to 13,000, was economically then getting a lot of goods in. What was so interesting to me is that the Depression may have worked in favor of the families. And I think that was outlined by the fact that the Brodies had no credit. They had, they were 19, my father would have been 20 years old when he started going to market in New York, probably with his father and a couple of his older brothers. And it must have been that in the face of the Depression, they saw an older man with a few of his sons, which reminds me of the musical The Rothschilds. But they would see that and they would extend them some credit because they were part of the Klan. And so I think that was they came over with nothing and they did survive in the Depression through that.
Nikki, really quick, can you talk about, is it your Uncle Edward? Great uncle?
No, he's not, just a regular uncle.
He's the last of the merchants on this panel to establish a storefront. So can you talk just really quickly about his early experiences?
Right. Yeah. Well, once his mom sent him down to Aunt Bessie and Uncle Joe to work in the store, to learn about the store, he was 15 years old at the time. He went to the College of Charleston at night, and obviously he was very ambitious. At 21, he opened his own store, Edwards, on King Street, not the bigger one across the street, but the first one. And he did it with very little money. I think Uncle Joe lent him some money. And he was very successful. And do you want me to go on anymore about that?
Yeah, so if we want to continue this narrative, how did the Great, so why don't you step forward to the Great Depression and how that impacted the family?
At this time it was still Uncle Edward. The brothers hadn't come down. They came in the 30s. But honestly, and most of this is really research that I did, I don't think the Depression really affected him that much because in 1930 he opened his second store in Bamberg. One of the reasons he opened it there was because the train line was on that route and because it was the county seat. I also think the Depression was slightly slower to hit the Deep South because they were still recovering from the Civil War and they didn't have a lot of money to invest. So people weren't, killing themselves or anything like that because they really didn't have the money. Later on, it got worse and it became hard and people were out of work. But in the beginning, when he started expanding in 1930, I don't think he was affected that much. In 1933, he married his wife, Hattie. They had a big reception and apparently it did not affect them that badly, personally. So.
And Bamberg wasn't the only store they opened in 1930s.
Well, Bamberg in 1930, but then I think he went on, and his second store was Walterboro, which was a couple years later, I think
33.
It could have been. I have it down here, but I'm not going to bother to read that. but he opened a store there, and then a couple of years later, he opened in Conway. And even though these places were affected by the Depression, again, Walterboro was on the railroad line, and things were not that bad. In Conway, even though cotton had the boll weevil in most of the farming counties, they were farming tobacco. So they were doing really well. That was basically the 30s. He did pretty well with all those stores.
And who's working in those stores?
All right. It started after that. I think it must have been after Walterboro, just judging from the date. But there were three other brothers, Meyer, Macy, and Milton, my father. And they came and started working for Uncle Edward in the stores. And then it went from there.
Mm-hmm. So they were manning other branches?
No, they were all working within the downtown store. They may have been sent out to do things, but they all lived in Charleston with their wives, so mm-hmm. they weren't going to leave and go to any of the little towns mm-hmm. to live.
Deborah, can you talk a little bit about whether or not the economic crash affected St. Stephen, or was this more of the same stasis?
Well, I don't think anything ever affected St. Stephen, to be perfectly honest. By 1924, Uncle Gus had already died. He was in a terrible car accident. He was 58 years old, so he was gone. Uncle Arthur opened a store in 1925, and the Reeds moved in 28, and they stayed there until the bitter end. So, no, I wouldn't say the crash affected them. In fact, there was a lumber company that moved into the St. Stephen area, taking advantage of the timber industry in the late 1920s. If anything, that brought more customers for them. Uncle Arthur, I'll explain, he had an appliance store, and the Reeds had a general merchandise store. They called it a department store. So they shared, and people in that area didn't have any place else to go to get any. They were their local department store, local everything. So this is why I don't think that it really mattered. The crash didn't affect them because they still carry the same things that people needed day to day.
The lumber mill that you mentioned, or the lumber industry, was there a mill town nearby that you know of?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. So there wasn't a company store, and so they were still traveling and visiting St. Stephen for goods.
Yes, okay. They must have.
Excellent. Harold, can you talk? You already spoke a little bit about this, but can you talk about what happened with the Brodies about 1929, and then after the crash with the move to North Carolina?
Yes, my Uncle Leo, who was one of the older Brody brothers, went to Sherall from Sumter. Didn't like it and decided he wanted something more comparable to Sumter, South Carolina. So he chose Kinston, North Carolina, which was a booming tobacco town in 1928. The population was around 11,000, the same as Sumter. It was a central location in eastern North Carolina, and just the Sumter County was filled with tobacco at the time. It was amazing that he opened in 1928 on the eve of the Depression. The idea in those days was to open in July or August before the crop came in, and it worked because they were successful. And before 1933, he then enlarged the store, moved up on the main street, which was called Queen Street, to a larger storefront. Very similar, again, to what happened in Sumter when the original shoe store had been expanded into a men's store and then into a department store. And he opened a second store in Greenville, South Carolina, around 1936 or 38. The population in Greenville was 11,000, still like Sumter, in 1936. So they were paralleling all of that. And at the time of World War II, my Aunt Ruth she was unmarried at the time, went to the Greenville store at 21 years old until her brothers returned from the war and managed the Greenville store. And what was interesting is that she found a room in a rooming house in Greenville to stay in for many, many months or years at the time, because it was run by a Greenville man who was married to a Jewish woman, and they would let her stay there. Because, as many of you will recall, at that time there were signs that said no Jews or dogs allowed in the motels and in the hotel industry. Otherwise, she couldn't stay in an organized apartment facility. Certainly not the YWCA. So that was kind of the situation.
So, David? We're going to jump back in time a little bit for your family. So our research shows that about 1888, so a little bit after the Charleston earthquake, Max Perscott potentially leaves Charleston, and then he returns about a decade later. So can you talk?
Actually, I'm going to actually jump back a little bit earlier than that, because it's in 1888, Max Perscott, my great-grandfather, would take trips back to Europe, and one of the big advertising ploys that they used at the time was that these were goods directly from, that they were buying directly from Europe, that this was not stuff coming from New York. So he was making, according to some family members, but not recorded, yearly trips back to Europe. And in 1882, he went with his family and three young children. There was a cholera epidemic, the fifth cholera epidemic, in Europe. Two of his children died over there, and they're buried in the cemetery in Nitra, Slovakia. So one tragedy then, but he continued to go back and forth. In 1886, the Charleston earthquake, he sent his family to New York, and he stayed on, and he was a prominent figure locally, and with the temple for that matter. He was president of the temple in 1914 later, but he was prominent in trying to help the earthquake recovery. But he moved in 1888 to New York to be with his family. A family joined the Temple of Emmanuel up there, which was a big Reform temple up there. But they kept the business. The businesses did not go away. He had other people, other family members working and managing here, and then he moved back sometime later, reestablished the store as Frischgott Brothers, or it was Kahn Frischgott and Benedict was the original name, and then Frischgott Brothers. But then it went on to being Max Frischgott and Sons, or M. Frischgott and Sons. Similar thing happened actually in Jacksonville. The Jacksonville Fire of 1901 was the largest fire tragedy on the East Coast. Not as well known as the big fires in Chicago and in San Francisco that preceded it, but nearly as tragic. And almost 200 blocks of downtown Jacksonville burned away. The stores there was damaged, but they rebuilt, and my great uncle Leopold, who had already moved to New York separately and was operating the business from there through relatives back in Jacksonville, did a lot to head up the recovery there as well. World War I came along. My great-grandfather was in Europe when World War I broke out, Archbishop, you have to look, lost a lot of sleep coming here at 1 o'clock in the morning last night, when Archduke was assassinated. He was behind, he was in Slovakia at the time, we assume. The front page of the Charleston newspaper ran an article, Max Frischgott caught behind enemy lines, and whereabouts unknown, and he was missing for several months. And much later, in the Charleston front page of the Charleston newspaper ran an article about him being found and returning to Charleston. Getting to the Depression really quickly, so tragedies do affect. That's when the last generation that had the stores, my grandfather and his two brothers, broke apart. One stayed here, business went out of business in a few years after the beginning of the Depression, for reasons that may have had to do with more with family and with the stability of my uncle than it had to do much more with than anything to do with the actual money. My grandfather, as I mentioned before, went to Orangeburg, opened a store there briefly, and then moved from there to Goldsboro, North Carolina, with the intent of becoming a North Carolina citizen, because he had two sons in school in North Carolina, and the only way he could afford to keep them at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, was if he was a resident there, which is fortunate because my Uncle Robert, as some of you know, did quite well as a result of his being at the University of North Carolina at that time. And then moved, after they established residency, then moved and opened another store yet in Florence to help with the store that the family, another family member had there. So it was a roundabout sort of bouncing with the flow as it went through.
I'm not sure if you can answer this, but after Max Frischgott got returns or is able to return during World War I, did the ongoing war affect the supply of any of the goods, or were they still importing?
They redirected, the emphasis on, as best I can tell from mostly from advertisements that they placed in the Charleston papers, they redirected their advertising, and they were no longer buying indirectly from Europe, which is a big deal. And they weren't, I should mention also, they didn't stock the stores they were backed with researching this now, with family money from the Herzog family, which was my great-great-grandmother's family. Philip Herzog was well established in New York in the 1850s. He was appointed by President Lincoln to work at the Customs House in New York, and was quite well off. His son was an inventor who invented something to do with the exchanges that we used for telephones at that time, the early telephone exchanges. And so they, although it's never written, it's sort of implied later on in family records. The money had to come from somewhere, and so that probably was where the money came from to help the businesses.
Harold spoke about this earlier, but would anyone else, so Mickey or Zach, like to talk a little bit about how World War II directly affected your family's business?
I would say that World War II greatly affected the business in a good way. So most of you know that in the 40s, they rediscovered Charleston Harbor, and it was inundated with shipping. The Navy Yard, the airport were expanded. The federal program poured millions into Charleston. Highway connections went to the rest of the state. By 1941, the Charleston Naval Yard became Charleston's largest industry. So I would say that things were very good. Although Ed did not open any stores until after the war, in 1947, he opened a store on Reynolds Avenue at the entrance to the naval base. Smart. Needless to say, it did very well. When he interviewed with the Post and Courier, this is what he said. The new location was chosen because of the growing importance of the section and the probability of new industry locating there. The store was a success. I'm saying that, never mind. One thing that I haven't brought in, this is a good time to bring it in. Uncle Edward immersed himself into everything in the city, every organization. He was very important within the non-Jewish world. He held many offices. He worked for war bonds and did a lot during the war. And so he actually had, he would learn a lot of things from all these organizations he was in. So as he opened stores, he knew lots about what was going on in each of the towns because he was very, very active. He also gave a lot of money away. I should say they all did. They all were working for the stores now. But he was still, it was still his stores, even though the brothers worked in there for many, many years. So going into the 50s, I would say that was probably the heyday of the Edwards stores, recovering from the war. And in, should I go on around the 1949 store?
Yeah.
I will say that in 1949, he opened the big King Street store, which was across from the original one. And he turned that into Ward's. And this was a big modern building at King and Morris Street. It was a celebration like you've never seen in Charleston before. They had 10,000 people at the opening. They brought in 2,500 orchids from Hawaii, which they gave away. Within 2 hours, they were out of them. It was huge. My grandmother, as usual, opened the doors for the people and continued to do so as long as she was alive. And Edward did emphasize it was a family business and it was a Charleston-owned business. And that apparently was a big deal, as Woolworths and Crest and Grant's and all those stores started becoming competitors. It's a Charleston-owned firm, store. And anyway, the 40s were great.
Zach, so the the 50s and 60s brought about some major changes for Sam Solomon Wholesale, which doesn't stay that way. Can you describe some of the innovation that was occurring?
Sure. In 1957, my father opened, and the Solomon family, because his brother Aaron and his brother-in-law, Joe Stillman, opened a store on East Bay Street. And it was a membership store. And that allowed it to be a discount store because everybody were buying for themselves. So that was the first thing. Then around that time, my father joined a group of people called the Merchandisers of America. And what they did, it was similar stores, and they were able to produce a catalog, a basic catalog, and then they each put their own covers on it. You know, so there were people in Florida, people in Chicago, people, and it allowed them to begin almost like collective bargaining, because since the bulk of the catalogs were the same, they could get together and get financing, get different pricing, get different deals than a lot of the local competition, or just be able to pass those kind of savings on. One of the things about the catalog, which was very interesting, is I've had so many people come and tell me that when that catalog hit, families would gather around and go through and mark the pages. And another interesting point, it was almost like the first e-commerce. There were mail order forms in the catalog. And there was a major section of the store that in the back part, in the warehouse part, where we packed and mailed large, people would buy goods by mail all over the local areas. So again, it's almost like it's an outbreak of the same kind of peddling, the door-to-door stuff, but instead you would get a package from Sam Solomon Company. So that was like the late 50s, going into the 60s. And my father had a vision. He was one of the first companies to really go computerized. And what that allowed them to do is they were one of the first companies in the country to have what they call point of sale equipment, something we take for granted now. But the bars that you would, that you would be able to use a wand to ring the cash registers, that was an entirely new concept. And this, again, was all happening. The major thrust of that was opening a second store in North Charleston, which had rows of these kind of newfangled cash registers. In addition, since it was the beginning of really using technology, we had our own computer center with the old IBM cases with the twirling tapes. And he had to hire a staff of programmers, because if you wanted to know what your inventory was, there was no software that you could buy. You had to build it. So a lot of these things really were very visionary and contribute to being able to scale up as they did, as they opened other stores in other areas. But I'll talk about that later.
Can you talk about whether or not the clientele changed at all? I'm thinking specifically about African Americans and being able to mail order items from the store.
A mail order slip had no, you didn't know who you were sending. I mean, I have never grown up with any kind of prejudice or, that wouldn't have been an issue at all. It's just whoever sent in the form got what they wanted.
Can you, Harold, all the way down here? Slightly similar question, but late 50s, early 1960s, Sumter was one of several towns in South Carolina that was really at the heart of the civil rights movement, places like Walterboro, Sumter, Orangeburg. Can you talk a little bit about the Brody family experience personally and then also professionally at the store?
Yes. The late Roger Ackerman, who was very, very helpful and moved to Sumter in the late 60s or the early 70s, made the comment at the inauguration of the Sumter Historical Center, in the Temple Sinai Center, that he had never really encountered any prejudice. Well, I certainly saw it. And in 1961 or so, when I was 12 years old and was making boxes in the store, they had a picket line. And the janitorial staff of the department store was out front picketing. And of course, this they didn't lose their jobs. The Brody brothers allowed this to go on and to happen because the South was just beginning to start to react to Brown versus Board of Education, and a little late, but they did in 1961. And so they had the picket line, and they also distributed a leaflet. And I picked up one of these leaflets, and I was curious, and I brought it in to my Uncle Jake, and he looked at it, and he crumbled it up and threw it in the trash can and turned on his heel and walked away from me. And I said, oh my God, no, and being the squirrel and pack rat that I am, I went to the trash can and I pulled it out. And I have it here, and I'm going to summarize it for you. It says, "Wake up, America. The Knights of the Ku Klux Klan distributed millions of handbills like this some years ago. Communism will not be tolerated. The KKK is awake. The Congress laughed. Communism is taught in our public schools, in our colleges, in our unions, in our motion pictures. Preachers have communistic ideas, and the Knights of the KKK is fighting against Negro domination to protect our white womanhood. And the Anti-Defamation League of the B'nai B'rith is pro-communist and calls Gentiles Goyin, G-O-Y-I-N, which means cattle, and seeks by block Negro voting smear tactics to build Jewish communist dictatorship in the United States. This we must prevent. The KKK is fighting communism and all other isms except pure Americanism." And then here's the address in Tuscaloosa and in Spartanburg, South Carolina. And I'm going to give that to Dale afterwards and put that there. But it does underscore the fact that there was anti-Semitism flagrantly there. And as I finished high school a couple of years later, I had two other Jewish friends, Natalie Moses and Gail Rubin and myself, and three Catholic friends, and we all congregated together because we knew we wanted to leave Sumter after we finished high school. And we went, it was on the radio, but we went to a KKKK meeting. It's not just KKK, it's four Ks, Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And they burned a cross at night about 20 miles outside, and the sheriff of Sumter County was there to protect things. And it was just uncommon, it was common knowledge that he was not only protecting it, but he belonged to the KKK. And so they burned a cross, and the girls that were with me talked to the guys out there, and they said they joined the KKK because their wife left them. There were excuses. It was a real educational experience. And the guy got up there, the grand visor, wizard of the KKK, and in a microphone, he started talking about what they would do if they had an FBI man there. Oh, they would string him up, and an FBI man. And then they said, what if it were a Negro FBI man? Except they didn't use the word Negro. They used the N word I'm not going to use. And then they said, well, what if it were a Negro Jew FBI man? And the cross is burning, and we're sitting there, and I turned to them, and I said, let's go. And we calmly walked to the gate down to where we had parked our car and left, and it was burned into my experience forever, as you can imagine. And so the leaflets, the actual prejudice was there. And I also remember there was a drive-in called Big Jim's that was the only drive-in in town, really, outside of Cole's Grill, in which, Anita will remember this, me from Sumter. But anyway, you drove around at night because there wasn't anything to do for the high school people to do in Sumter. And I got out of the car on a Saturday night, and this guy I barely knew, not even on speaking terms, hollered, "Hey, Jew," at me, about 1964. And one of my wise friends with me said, "Don't listen to him, Harold." And I didn't, but you can't forget an experience like that. So that's my encounters with anti-Semitism and integration in Sumter. It was a riveting experience, and I think it really happened.
Okay, may I? While we're bringing up this topic, I think we have to discuss the blue laws. Now, it was a little later in time, you know, it was the maybe early 60s. My uncle Aaron Solomon was very devout. And he, a lot of the other retailers in town were open on Saturday and closed on Sunday. So he was of the belief that since Saturday was the day of rest, he should be entitled to open on Sunday. So they did it. The other retailers complained to the police. The police showed up and shut them down. So my Uncle Aaron took the case to the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court chose not to enforce, chose not to abolish the blue law, so they took it to the federal Supreme Court. And the federal court refused to opine on it, saying it was a state right, a state's rights problem. Well, Charleston being what it was, some of the police were more flexible than others. And what happened was they developed this scheme that it was a $50 fine to open on Saturday. So every Saturday they came, collected the $50, and the store would open.
And that,
I mean, Sundays. Sundays. And that's how it worked. You know, just everybody kind of smiled, and, you know, nod, nod, wink, wink, and that's how it ended up. But it was a several year, it took several years to get to that point, because they were still enforcing it. It was very interesting, not to cast any aspersions, but we think that the police were pushed by other merchants who felt that being open on Sunday was a disadvantage to them. So just want to make that point. Thank you.
Does anyone else want to share any experiences?
Well, were you closed on Saturday?
Yes, closed on Saturday.
You were closed on Saturday?
Yes.
And open on Sunday?
Correct.
Does anyone else want to share any experiences about late 50s, early 60s with desegregation? And Harold, you're welcome to chime in again, but I know that some of our research has shown that there were, of course, boycotts in places like Orangeburg and Walterboro, in which there were some white merchants that remained open and that were penalized, but a lot of what we found doesn't say who exactly those merchants were, and I'm curious if any of y'all have any idea in Sunder.
I think that because my uncles and my father allowed them to picket and did not say you're going to be fired if you go out there and do that, that something may have dodged a bullet.
So, Deborah, what's happening in St. Stephen during this time period? So, we're in the 50s and 60s now. Is it still worse than Bucky? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was still the 60s, and there were horse and buggies in the 60s. And I can remember speaking to one of the Reeds, Sally Kate Reed, who's the daughter of Paul Reed, and she told me that they didn't even have a television in the 60s, and they had to go to my Uncle Arthur's store, and he would open it up and let the kids watch television in his store. And that was sort of the winding down of the whole era, because my Uncle Arthur became very sick, and he shut his store in the early 70s. I believe the Reed shut their store also in the 70s. But it never really prospered. Nothing happened. They didn't grow. They didn't fail. They were a basis for everything that everybody needed. And my impression was they were more like family in that community, and that they had to be, because it kept other people from having to go to the great metropolises of Monk's Corner, for example. So. And Ben Barron's son is here, Ed Barron's son is here, and who owned a large store in Monk's Corner. And then the interstate came through, but that didn't change anything either, you would think. And people didn't move as much on the railroad, they didn't ride it as much. And so it basically went into decline, is what happened. And there were so... At a point in the 70s, there were no Jewish merchants anymore.
Okay. Mickey, so as another major retailer in Charleston, how was Edward's trajectory different or similar to what was happening with Sam Solomon in the late 50s and early 60s? Y'all were still continuing to expand, right? Additional stores?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. The 50s were really another boom time for them. Actually, Uncle Ed came up with the idea to do a shopping center in 1958, and that's when he opened Pine Haven Shopping Center. And of course, Edwards went into that one also. And by then, I think they, let's see, they might have had, I'm not sure how many stores by then, but he had a great deal of stores then. And they were affected somewhat by desegregation and the commotion. In 1963, they boycotted a lot of the merchants on King Street. They had a blacklist. Edwards was not on the blacklist, which was fortunate, but they boycotted out front and blocked the door. And I think Uncle Ed was pretty mad because the whole time he was in Charleston, he would give to the black churches. He might have given discreetly. You didn't want all your very important friends to know you were doing it, but he was very generous to the black churches. So he was a little angry, but other than that, it was major, actually. 1963 was major because a lot of the merchants kind of picked Edward to head a little group of the merchants. They all got together and they decided, all right, let's go ahead and integrate our store staff. And that was when it happened. And I think the other big time in Charleston was 1969 when they had the hospital strike. But even though it affected business, because they had tanks in the street, they had curfews, and people were afraid to go downtown shopping, I don't think it was like a major, major deal. I mean, it came and it went, and it was over. So it still took a very, even today, African Americans don't have it that great. And in those days, they really didn't have it great. So, but that was the only, as for me, I was so sheltered during the 60s. I went to a private school. You didn't talk about it at the dinner table. It just wasn't something that your parents didn't really talk about, a lot of things that were going on in their personal life or business life. So I was completely sheltered until I went to Tulane, and they integrated, I think it was my freshman year, and really wasn't a big deal. I made some African-American friends. So I wasn't personally affected that much by all the riots and things like that.
Our final section is about the nature of competition. So we're going to talk a little bit about the arrival and impact of big box stores like Kmart, but also what it meant to be in business with and kind of competing against family and friends and what is often a very tight-knit community. So David, can you talk a little bit? Your family has periods in which there are individuals, there are brothers, and then later Max and his sons who are coming together in business and then subsequently kind of forging different paths. Can you talk a little bit about the original brothers' relationship and kind of how that evolved over time?
When my grandfather, my uncle Arthur was the last of the Prescott brothers to pass away. He was 97 when he died, and I asked him about my great-grandfather, who had died in 1921. I said, Uncle Arthur, you were alive when he was, can you tell me some things about him? He said, David, I was 5 years old. I said, did he have an accent? He said, what does a five-year-old know about an accent? So it's really hard to get in. There's no first-hand information about this that's available from anybody in the family. However, apparently the three brothers, the first set of three brothers in the 1860s, must have gotten along famously because they seemed to have taken care of each other well. They migrated over at age 16 and 19. They started their businesses here at age 21 and 5 years later at age 21 and 24. And the third brother, they brought their third brother over who was 13 years old at that time. They advertised, even though they were actually with separate ownership of these stores, they advertised together and they treated it as one. So we have stationary invoices and such from back then. Frischgott stores in Jacksonville, for example, and they'd have there was an Atlanta store for about 5 years. They'd have the Atlanta store address. They'd have the buying address in New York, and they'd have the Charleston and the Jacksonville stores together. So they seemed to do well. The next generation, my grandfather's generation, didn't seem to do as well, possibly because of the stress of the Depression, but more likely because all generations don't seem to always have the entrepreneurship in it than others do. And then nobody in the generation of my father's, nobody was really a merchant of that sort in the family, you know, the doctors and engineers and scientists, whatever. It's a different sort of thing, but the family relationships that seem to be important to me as I've been researching this, and as I say, my cousin Allison really has dug into it a lot deeper. The family relationships, including with the Herzog family, which again was on my great-great-grandmother's side, was enough to help support getting the businesses going and bringing people over one by one as they came.
Does anyone want to elaborate? Well, I guess we'll just keep going. Deborah? Did St. Stephen experience the arrival of the box store?
Again, a very abbreviated response. No. Poor St. Stephen. It's still kind of a hole in the wall place. I went there last November and it's a total shell. I don't know what I was expecting. But it's really sad. However, I'm really hoping with the rise of the economy in Berkeley County that it's going to cause growth and development to expand to St. Stephen as well, because it has a lot of potential. The Main Street is very cute. It really is. You can tell that, you know, something can be done, and I'm sure with Google coming in and W International and who are they? JW Aluminum and defense contractor W International and Goose Creek, they're bound to be developers who are going to want to move in and create opportunities. Again, historically, Berkeley County has been a boom and bust economy from the refugees, from the French Huguenot planters, and onward, and I think that this is the time for Berkeley County to shine again. I'm just, hope springs eternal, so we'll just have to wait and see. I have inherited the family property there, so what's left. My Uncle Arthur bought 6 lots there in 1932 for $150. He sold off 5 of the lots, and the one little lot left has been coming slowly but surely down the family tree, and I have it. I paid $78 in taxes last year. And I just got a notice from the treasurer's office that's going up to $300 this year.
Oh, that gets serious.
So, Mickey, Charleston was obviously a major market for big box stores. Can you talk about how Edwards did or did not change leading up to the acquisition in the 1970s?
Well, first of all, Edwards Sons took over the business. They went into the business in the 60s. In the 70s, my cousin Avram took over the business from Ed. Unfortunately, the 70s were not so great. The boys expanded on what he thought was, he actually, in the beginning, he liked the concept that Woolworths had, so he used it when he did open most of his stores. By the 70s, the square footage of the stores had more than doubled. The stores were much bigger. They actually had become junior department stores. Maybe they were trying to compete with the Kmarts and the Walmarts. I don't know. I couldn't get into their head, but I think also they were trying to, you know, this was theirs now, and they were going to do what they wanted to do with it, not what Ed's idea of what they should be. Mm-hmm. So in the meantime, there was also, well, by this time they had, I would say, I guess around 20, about 28 stores. So you're talking about a lot of stores. They had also built a very large warehouse. And to keep the warehouse profitable, they had to keep opening stores. So they opened more stores, bigger stores. And sometime within the 70s, one of their stores in Lawrence, South Carolina, flooded. Unfortunately, there was no insurance on it, and it was a total loss. A couple of years later, the same thing happened again. So they lost a good deal of money from those two stores, from that store flooding two times. There are a lot of other circumstances in the 70s. There was a recession, interest rates went to 20%. They didn't have a lot of money. They used to take the profits and open the next store. So there was not a lot of money to really put into the stores, but yet they kept opening them. They also had a deal with a real estate company that he would open the store in a shopping center, and but they had to open a couple stores a year to do it. So between this and the competition, which really, of course, got great, as everyone knows, with the big box stores, I think in the 70s, on top of all that, they opened 17 stores all over the state and two in Georgia. So I think that was pretty much the beginning, I mean the end, just the beginning of the end of Edwards in the late 70s. If they maybe had kept with the smaller scale stores of Edward, all those stores are opening now, those dollar stores, which are basically dime stores. Mm-hmm. And they seem to be pretty successful, I don't know. But it was just too much. And by 1977, they were bought out. And that was the end of it. So that was the big box stores in Edwards.
So Harold, what's happening in Sumter in the late 1960s and early 1970s? Competition, people branching out, and then same thing, arrival of the big box stores.
Yes, three of the male cousins went into the family business, and of course they weren't going to have any females in there. So two of my cousins that were female went into, one went to Atlanta and worked for Macy's, and the other one eventually opened a place of her own in Hilton Head. But the three male cousins that went into the business, I was not one of those. The other three went into medicine. I was one of those, and Phil and Stuart Greenberg were the other two. And we went into medicine, and so my experience was, I was involved as a bystander, and I saw in the late 60s, several employees sneak away and open stores down the street, and everybody did well. That internal competition like that was fine. And even in the early 70s, A young high school graduate opened a place called Duck Inn Menswear with a duck, getting the hunting competition and that sort of business. And my father by then was in his late 60s and wished him well. And I think the Vietnam era may have mellowed everybody on that. But the big competition in Sumter, of course, was Kmart. And Kmart represented the mall versus the town. And the mall was out going to a Choi Air Force Base and was closer than the town. And the town suffered. And they changed the main street into a mall called the Sumter Town, T-O-W-N-E, Mall, and decorated it up. And it did not succeed. And they put the parking places back and took the mall away. The uniqueness of a huge store with more merchandise and a lot less personal service, mall or not, was a draw for consumers at the time. And the Brodies in Sumter, whenever we went on vacation, we would look at the store windows everywhere else, and that included Sam Solomon. But it certainly, the distance to Columbia was half the distance to Charleston. And so Columbia was a center, and the Brodies always used Columbia as a comparison. The Berries over there, Nathan and Paul and Joe Berry, were good friends for Jewish liaison comparisons. Shaw Air Force Base was drawn to these giant stores. The chance to expand and to do what they wanted to do was really not feasible at that particular time, and the chains cutting the profits of the smaller merchants. And most smaller merchants, like the Brodies, had savings at that point because, of course, you could, the stock market had done well. The 50s were a time of prosperity, and so were the 60s. And they didn't go out of business, but they elected after their deaths to sell to larger groups like Profits, which owned Saks and that sort of business. But it was a time when Mr. Kmart was showing success, and they did suffer for it.
Thank you. Zach, so the Sam Solomon company, retail company, closed in the 1980s. Is that story similar to everyone else on the panel, or is it a little different?
It's slightly different in that where we were most successful was really being the only game in town. You know, so they would expand into like the smaller cities. And what really caused our downfall, I think, was when we moved to Florida. Because the whole nature of the consumers were entirely different. They were more big boxes there than the typical places where we would choose. And the people weren't afraid to cherry pick. Meaning they would come to you for a toaster, they'd go across the street for, you know, a blender. And it became so competitive. And at that point, everybody's margins were decreasing, again, because of the finance costs, different things like that. I mean, we'd do things like, and we weren't the typical store in that a lot of those stores had, where you fill out and you submit and they bring you your goods. These were stock shelves, clipboard. Yeah, these were stock shelves. You went in with the shopping cart, you filled your cart, you checked out. At the same time, because of the Port of Charleston, we would go to the Orient and we're one of the first people to direct ship stuff to Charleston. And it would be amazing. The thing that was the most profitable were Christmas tree lights. Because if you bought them in China and you brought them over, you know, so we were doing that. We had distribution centers. We would go to Israel and buy packages of diamonds and make our own jewelry. You know, so we were trying to do, but again, the big stores, when you have 8 or 10 stores and you're fighting Kmart or Walmart that have hundreds, they can even undercut that. So it was really when we went from rural to urban that was not what we were supposed to be doing. And that kind of takes back all the way to where we began with the peddlers. You know, that what we did, what all of us did, were we dealt with people from customer service. And I think the big stores came around, it was just about a price point. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what really changed the complexion of Jewish merchant.
Do you want to talk a little bit, pass the mic, about your family's philanthropy? And I'm going to maybe direct this towards everyone on the panel, because as we wrap up before we do the Q&A, we kind of want to talk about kind of the family's legacy, what happened to the the store, that original store, and if there are plans to redevelop it, and those kind of things. And but how does your family name kind of live on, this merchant name, in various enterprises and philanthropic ventures?
Okay, we'll start with the physical building. The East Bay Street building, which was the first one opened, covered a block. So what it is now is they demolished, and it's a shopping center. So it's like they took away the building. I mean, the walls are still there, but it's now a parking lot in the middle and all that kind of stuff. So it's been, that was kind of interesting. Philanthropically, my father has always been committed to both Jewish and non-Jewish charities. He served on the Saul Alexander board. He was one of the people who brought Spoleto to Charleston. He was on the Gibbs board, as well as all the other Jewish charities. You know, in terms of the legacy, you know, his grandchildren serve on synagogue boards. His great-grandchildren are presidents of synagogue youth chapters. Mayor Riley and Ted Stern, who's president of the College of Charleston, talked at his memorial about how he was just a man. You know, it wasn't about him being a Jew. But to know my father, I think he always was a Jew first and a mensch second. And, we've served on school boards, we've served on library boards. My Aunt Muriel was the longest serving volunteer at Roper Hospital. She buried a time capsule and was there when they dug it up. You know, so we've always been in the community.
Would you like to share anything?
Sure. Hebrew Benevolent Society? I think that's the oldest Jewish charity in the United States. Is that
right? Hebrew Orphan Society.
Hebrew Orphan Society.
No, yeah. Hebrew Benevolent's older than Hebrew Orphan.
There
is
we
it?
Go. That's the one. Okay. Yeah. My great grandfather was one of the founding members of that, if I recall correctly. And they were involved in charities. They weren't very upfront about it. Wasn't a very public thing, but it was more, when it came to be a public thing, it was during the crisis times, like during, in Jacksonville during the fire, and in Charleston during the earthquake time. But it was a behind the scenes thing, and certainly very involved directly with the temple.
Yeah, would you like to share anything, or about what the Edwards,
the legacy?
Is it at King and what's the cross street, Edwards at King and Morris?
Morris. Well, I just want to kind of echo what Zach said about his family, not to try to outdo you or anything, but my uncle Edward, all the boys were very philanthropic, and they worked for the community, but. Again, and I didn't even know this until I researched that this man was just golden. I mean, he must have been a genius. He must have served as president. Well, he served as president of the Gibbs Art Gallery, of the State Development Board. He was president of the Chamber of Commerce. He was president of almost every organization in the city. And the only legacy really that I would like to see, all four boys, they were very philanthropic. They gave to countless organizations. Anybody who asked Edward for money, he would give to them. And I would say that I would like to know that many worthwhile causes did very well because of the family. They did well. They liked to give back to the community. They felt that Charleston gave them a wonderful life, even though Meyer and Macy had moved away. They Macy was very active in Israeli things, and I just think if that's a legacy, of course, no one eventually will remember the stores because, you know, that generation will be gone. But if the charities could do well because of them, that's my only wish.
Don't forget Emmanuel.
Oh, well, in Jewish things, I wish I had time to name all the things they did. They did help found Emmanuel. Macy was the first president. Edward was a treasurer. All of them worked hard in Emmanuel in founding it and over the years. So, I mean, there's just too many things to name, so I won't try.
Deborah, would you like to share any? You talked a little bit about your hopes for St. Stephen, but what about the legacy of your uncle, Arthur and the Reed family? Okay. What would you like to see kind of happen with that?
Well, I think what's already happened with him is that he was, he loved St. Stephen to the bottom of his heart, and he did everything that he could. And in fact, in 1973, he was awarded the Municipal Association of South Carolina's Public Service Award. He was responsible for organizing the town's fire department in the early 1930s, and they had some pretty terrible fires there. He served as a fire chief and waterworks commissioner. He acted as mayor pro tem for numerous terms and functioned as the acting mayor to complete unexpired terms of office. And there are a few more things, but his health finally declined. Although he was never an observant Jew, his grandfather, who had been a rabbi in Germany, Uncle Arthur epitomized what a Jew meant by his character and his good deeds. There is a Lippmann Drive named after him, and the mayor proclaimed an Arthur Lippmann Day once a year. I'm not sure when it is. But there was an event in St. Stephen that I was invited to, somebody's 50th wedding anniversary at the VFW, and I went, and literally I stood on the same spot for an hour. I was trying to get to the chocolate fountain. And I couldn't move. I was just saying, oh, that's Arthur Lippmann's niece. I said, no, it's great niece. And he was just so revered. And so he has definitely left a legacy there. The store that he used to own is now a place of worship. And the Reed store is sort of like a thrift store. To see what do I want to see happen, I'd like to see a revival of St. Stephen, and I think many of the other citizens would want that as well, because I think there is opportunity for growth in St. Stephen.
And Harold?
Well, the Brody's eventually sold, and the Brody building was vacant in Sumter, the original store, and it was sold to the city of Sumter. It's now a adjunct office for city services. The Capital Department store was sold to a company like Profits, which was a parent company of Saks. And now it was three storefronts. One of them is vacant. I went by there yesterday. And the other two have small retail outlets in it. But there are a lot of vacant stores on the main street there in Sumter, South Carolina. We own several of those storefronts that are not occupied. The family name in Sumter continued with the Alex Brody Pavilion, and of course, in the 50s, they established the Brody Educational Building at Temple Sinai, which we have still kept up with that building, and it is now being expanded into the Temple Sinai Historical Center. In North Carolina, there was comparable history. The old Kenson store became an arts council or a nonprofit, which happens when the city gets hold of it. Part of it was absorbed by Hyman Stadium. Some of you may know who. His son, Hyman Stadium, also just still has that men's store up there. In Greenville, North Carolina, the store was sold and became a popular restaurant, but the Brody name is still on the floor when you enter because Michael Jake had tiles resembling the logo on the outside of the store. The Brief Branch stores at the highest portion of the time when they were successful in Goldsboro, New Bern, Rocky Mountain, Jacksonville, all were rented buildings. But the family name in North Carolina, in Kinston and Greenville, the Brody Building that houses the Brody School of Medicine in East Carolina, the Brody Nurses Award for Excellence in Nursing, the Brody Scholars Program, which has enabled over 140 doctors to graduate from medical school in North Carolina with reduced or no debt to serve the mission of family medicine in North Carolina has prevailed, and I think it's probably the most incredible thing that they did when they were still alive, because most of them lived to be in their 90s. They also, at Duke University, which is my alma mater, established Brody Scholarships, a Brody Theater at Duke, the cafe at the National, at the Art Museum, and the Charlotte Brody Discovery Gardens. So I think they left a fine legacy, and the cousins are familiar and trying to continue with that. Of interest, Nathan Addlestone was a good friend of my father's, the father of Susan and Carol Addlestone, and he discussed his move to Charleston with my father after his divorce from his first wife, Ruth Addlestone. I don't know if any of you ever remember her. And they did discuss Jewish philanthropy in the 1960s and what they intended to do. And I was there for some of that conversation, even though there was an adversarial relationship between Ruth and Nathan at that particular time. But I remember those conversations when we went fishing at a little cabin years and years ago. Thank you for letting me remember all of this.
Thank you, everyone, for sharing all these stories. We covered about 60 years. We still have about 5 minutes for questions. If anyone wants to ask the panelists anything.
Carol, I wonder if you could comment on...
Mickey, why don't you talk about time for a tower?
He's kidding.
Michael.
Because I have relatives bishops, which is, of course, near Sumter. At one time, I think the town of Bishopville, maybe about 1,000 people,
no,
most,
was 30 years
had about 30-odd Jewish people. Yeah. And they were members, for the most part, of the synagogue and so is this something that you can comment on?
Yes, Bishopville did have the Traub family, the Irvin Traub family, and they were mainstays in the Temple Sinai in Sumter, and I knew them well, and my father interacted with them. The other families in Bishopville, Krasnov and Levinson, also sure were there, and it was
Ginsburg,
Ginsburg, of course, the Ginsburgs. You know, it was 13 miles away, so it was like they were extensions of each other, the towns, and I knew them. I haven't seen them in years, but the children of those scions, I should say.
Is anyone else? Was there someone?
I was yelling, the Kronbergs donated the hospital.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, there is a wing named after Uncle Ed. That's basically, yeah. There's a wing at Roper Hospital because he worked on that board for about 27 years. And there's a portrait of him also. I know, every time you go there.
It's the first kind of portrait.
Anyone else?
It's Halsey. Edwards was in Sumter, South Carolina, and I had no idea they were Jewish owned and operated.
That's what's good
about
these
meetings. Well, you had
McClellan's,
and you had Kress, and you had Edwards. Those were the three big ones. But,
fantastic. Thank you all so much to all of our panelists. Please join me in giving them a round of applause.